Hi, and welcome back to Soul Survivors. I'm Megan Cornwell, Deputy Editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. We were expecting to broadcast episode 5 of the podcast this week, but instead, we had the opportunity to sit down with Matt and Beth Redman after the release of their documentary, Let There Be Light. In this 30-minute film, they describe for the very first time the abuse they experienced at the hands of Soul Survivor founder Mike Plavacci, and how attempts to raise the alarm with other church leaders were dismissed. In this exclusive interview with the Redmans, which you're about to hear, they share more deeply their views on the church's culture of silence, as well as the actions of a man they describe as a skillful manipulator. Thanks, Matt and Beth. It's great to speak to you today. You've just released Let There Be Light, a short documentary which explores the abuse that you both faced at Soul Survivor Church and at the hands of Mike Plavacci. After all these years of carrying this, how does it finally feel to have your voices heard and believed?
Yeah, I mean, we were really keen to be part of making this documentary just to give some more context and some more detail to what happened. Obviously, we've put out a couple of things on social media, little statements in the past, but it's been nice to have the chance to speak in a bit more detail, and really the hope is that will help a lot of victims. It seems like every time we've said anything, there's a wave of people coming forward, and hopefully this will unlock some more freedom for people and really help the church think about some of these safeguarding structures.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that went through my mind for years is when you can't stay, but you can't say. And that requires so much strength, because, you know, you can look like you're flaky, or you don't like somebody, or you're against something, and you know the truth is so different. You would love nothing. We would have loved nothing more to have stayed in Soul Survivor and been part of this wonderful ministry, shaping the lives of young people, discipling them. And so actually, in one way, it's a relief to be able to tell more of the truth. It feels more appropriate. It feels the time is now. But obviously, it still feels very sad. It feels in many ways we're still doing it in isolation. And I think specifically, as this has come out and the NST investigation established, you know, 4 decades of various types of abuse, I think the silence from many leaders didn't sit right with me. And, you know, we do live in an age of vultures and cancel culture and trolls, and it's not right for everyone to speak out. But I think the silence from a lot of leaders, even today as we launch Let There Be Light, I think is part of the problem in church culture. Why can't we just say it is wrong that somebody abused their platform and privilege, and we stand with survivors, and we stand against, you know, spiritual, psychological, emotional, physical abuse? I don't know what is so hard about that for leaders in the church today to say.
Mm. Yeah. Do you have a sense of why there has been such silence? Because, I mean, you've obviously been part of the church for a long time. You guys have been, you know, your worship leaders, you've led churches, both in the UK, in America. What's your sense? How would you diagnose this problem, this illness of silence? What is causing these leaders? What's stopping them from speaking out in your view?
When this story first broke about a year ago, I can understand in many ways that there was a lot of disbelief. You know, could this really be true? We've seen so much good through Soul Survivor and apparently through Mike's ministry. And so I kind of get that it took people a while to figure out, is this actually real and, you know, legit? I think at this point, it is a little bit harder to understand. I mean, you've had a Church of England investigation that nearly 150 people have spoken to, and all of these various claims, coercive control, emotional, psychological, spiritual, physical abuse has all been substantiated by that. And I think at that point, it becomes a little bit harder to understand why there's such a culture of silence. Because I think if you look at some of these comments on social media, a lot of people are crying out for some voice. They're saying, you know, where are the leaders in this moment? Who are the people who will rise up and speak into this? And I think maybe there can be a fear, you know, to say things in the social media domain. You never know if you'll get trolled or where they lead to. But I think it's so important. It's so important because there's people who need to be spoken up for.
Yeah, and also like, that's really good, Matt. We want to also say we have compassion for leaders who partnered with Mike and platformed him because he was their friend. And so they're also people who are going through a process of grief and shock and disbelief, or, you know, there are phases, and they would have potentially felt stunned and confused. But I think now, over, you know, a year later, the fact that there is still so much silence, to me, actually underlines how this was allowed to go on so long. How can we still be being silent? And so, no, we can't demand anyone does anything. But I think it's an important reflection of church culture today.
You talked, Matt, just a minute ago about some of the aspects of abuse that Mike perpetrated. You know, you talked about psychological abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse. Can we just hear a bit more from you about the impact this has had on you and your family, you know, your mental health, your spiritual health? Can you share a bit more about the impact of some of these patterns of behaviour on you personally?
Yeah, obviously I'd had quite a troubled upbringing, even up to the point where I met Mike. I'd lost my father when I was 7 years old, and then I'd been sexually abused, and Mike was the person I told about that. And, you know, I look back on those moments, and it's quite hard to revisit, because at the time there was just utter relief that I got to tell this youth leader what had been happening to me, and he helped me go to the police. But now, as I look into it and some of the patterns, you know, he would counsel me about that abuse, and he'd want to know all the different details of what happened, but then he would wrestle me afterwards. And at the moment that felt uncomfortable. Now it feels way more than that. It's very, very troubling. And actually, when I spoke to the investigation about that, they actually advised me to speak to the police on that. So I realized, okay, this is a very serious thing, you know, even more serious than I had realized. And then, it's just, I felt like I dealt with a lot of this in life, but obviously speaking about it makes you revisit it again. And honestly, one of the hardest things has been hearing some of other people's stories, partly because there's people that we knew and loved that we didn't know had gone through some of this. Partly because of the scale of it, realizing, oh my goodness, so many people experienced these troubling and abusive behaviors. And also because some of them match up so much with my own experience, like, oh, that's exactly what happened to me. It was done in exactly the same way. And it made me realize, oh, I don't think this was just like accidental. I can't help myself. I'm emotionally unhealthy from Mike. I think it was, some of it seems to be, it's hard to say it, but like a skillful manipulator and creating these things, going into them a bit more mindfully than I realized. And honestly, that's really hard to think about.
I mean, that's one of the questions I've certainly had through the whole process of working on this documentary and this investigative podcast, Soul Survivors, which I know you guys have been following. You know, this idea that who is Mike Pilavarci? You know, this, we thought we knew who he was. We thought we knew that he was this leader who was admired and respected and celebrated. But then we're hearing all these other things about him. That's really confusing for a lot of people who I think have been to the festivals, who have experienced God in those moments, who perhaps even had prophetic words from Mike. What would you say to those people who are really confused now about whether they did encounter God in that ministry?
I mean, I think there's no doubt that this was a move of God. The nature of the way it, you know, it sprung to life, and there was this massive momentum behind it. And it doesn't invalidate any of those stories of salvation and healing and freedom and people going deeper and deeper in their faith. It's just a very, very sad thing that the heart of it, there was a contradiction in the senior leader, in the main leader. And it's one of those mysteries we may never really get to the bottom of, you know, how is God doing all this amazing stuff, and yet at the heart of it, there's this massive compromise of character in the very person leading the whole thing. And you know, I struggle to understand it myself, honestly. I'm a lot of my journeys, a lot of entanglement, you know, between, okay, in one sense, I was getting mentored. I did get some worship leading advice and brought on in that area and encouraged and firm. But at the same time, I've been told by, you know, several professionals I was being groomed. And I don't really understand how those two things can coexist. But I do understand that somehow in his beautiful grace, God, you know, plants stuff in the soil of our suffering. And I don't really get it, but there is definitely some nutrient in that soil of suffering. And I look back and I think, God, there's some things I really don't understand, but there's some things I really do. I can see your goodness shining through. I can see you turning pain into purpose. You know, I can see so many good things. And I would encourage anyone who's struggling with that kind of mystery or that tension, that paradox, you know, hold on to the good. You know, don't throw out the good. There's been so much good through Soul Survivor.
Yeah, that's so good, Matt, because I think it is true to say, you know, as real as what you've just said is, that is what you experience, but not everyone had that, knew that side of Mike, and so much good did happen at Soul Survivor. And so we get it. Like, it's so hard for so many people to believe and compute this image of a godly man then doing this sort of thing. That's a process you've got to go through. And I think for Matt and I, we also went through it, because I went to Soul Survivor when I was 19, first time ever, didn't know these people. I thought Matt was very cute, I have to say. But, you know, I experienced it firsthand. So I get it. I'm like, wow. But I also went behind the curtain, and I know that what I experienced was real, and it's been confirmed to me, and it's been confirmed by what happened to my mental health and my life and my own faith struggles. So it's a lot to navigate. Mm-hmm. And we don't get to help everyone through that journey. You know, people will deconstruct their faith, or this is a process, you know, but I believe Jesus is there waiting to meet us. And I've surrendered needing to know and needing to understand, and I've committed to doing what I believe Jesus is already doing, which is bringing this into the light and doing my part.
Yeah, and one thing I will add is I think that Mike Pilavarci had many opportunities along the way to change. Actually, God sent a lot of people to confront him. A lot of people spoke to him and then spoke to others in authority over him. And sadly, that all met with a brick wall and nothing was done. And I, you know, I don't really, it must be so crazily uncomfortable for Mike right now, because this is a very harsh light upon him. You know, this, you know, people speaking on social media and various things and things like our Let There Be Light documentary coming out. That's a much harsher process than maybe it needed to be. And I feel if I look back, I can see so many times that from people who loved him and with kindness in the mix, he was confronted, but he chose to try and silence those people. And that's why we're at where we're at now.
Yeah, and that is also scripture working itself out. You know, when you look at something like Matthew 18, what happens when there's a grievance? Obviously, I'm not talking about sexual abuse victims or anything like that when I'm talking about the context of Matthew 18 there. But when there's a fracture in a relationship or a misunderstanding or an abuse, then you know, you go to that person. It's a private one-on-one thing. And there's an opportunity there for repentance and reconciliation and restoration. And then if that process isn't followed, if that person in that one-on-one moment refuses to hear, then it goes on to say, we'll bring another with you. And then there's a third person now able to help that person. It's still private, it's still covered, there's mercy there. And then if that fails, you take it to the church. That's a much more painful process that didn't need to be a thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if you continue reading Matthew 18, the fallout of then you take it to the church and there is still not repentance or acceptance or you know, it's a painful situation now, much more so for Mike, I believe.
Yeah. And we didn't take it lightly, making, you know, this documentary and being part of that, and speaking on that, absolutely didn't enter into that lightly. It felt maybe like a necessary thing to do at this point, and to tell a bit more of the story and give people some more context. We felt that would be really helpful. We also wanted to bring in some experts like Dr. Diane Langberg and Dr. Chi-Chi, who's a consultant psychiatrist in Harley Street, London, and also Dr. Amy Orr-Ewing, who's a friend of ours, to speak some wisdom and expertise into the areas of how the church can grow in this area of safeguarding and how victims can find resources. You know, it was very important to us in this moment, but we didn't enter into it lightly.
Yeah, and what's really powerful about this story, actually, we did go to senior church officials and leaders, and we tried to follow the process, you know, internally, but it ended up really, I think Jesus used people we never expected, you know, to bring this to light. People like Dr. Amy Orr-Ewing, who felt like she was the first to really stick her neck on the line and take that step forward to really bring light. And then there was online bloggers, you know, just lone people at a keyboard, you know, setting up Twitter accounts like Needs Light, saying, no, we're not going to let this go. We're going to stand with survivors. We're going to keep pressing until there's change. And that's what's both sad and beautiful about this, is that the people in positions of authority at the time, historically, and even up to very recently, you know, if you watch the documentary, turned away, didn't want to help, actually further oppressed. And it was the people that God used were the people you would least have expected to really help bring light and, you know, make a way for survivors to be believed, heard. And we hope eventually for there to be some kind of disciplinary process, but that's out of our control. And I would say we release that outcome to the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. That's really powerful, Beth and Matt. I just want to pick up on something from the documentary. You know, you talk specifically about how damaging emotional and psychological abuse can be. And I think you also talked about how it just sort of isn't taken seriously. And I just wondered whether you thought that that had anything to do with the reason that this story took so long to become public.
I mean, I don't think it is. I mean, I think Amy does a phenomenal job in the documentary of really explaining how that can be an issue. But if it's not, you know, it's not sexual abuse in this way, then it's not abuse. She does a phenomenal job. But I think it was because Mike was powerful and he surrounded himself with a certain kind of person that he was, you know, accountable to. And clearly that was not an accountability structure whatsoever.
Mm. Matt, you mentioned in the film about wishing that you had left earlier, you know, left Soul Survivor earlier, and you can see that you're quite pained when you say that. Why do you think it was difficult to break those ties with Mike, even after you'd left? You know, there were still some moments of sort of relationship, you know, either coming back to Soul Survivor or relationships between you and your family and him. Why do you think it was so hard to let go completely? Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, it feels very complicated, honestly. I think for me, I was 13 years old. I told him this massive secret, something that's happened to me. He helped me walk through that and helped me go to the authorities about that. And from that moment, I say in the documentary, I think I had an undying loyalty to him. But it's definitely deeper than that. There's so many things. You know, you help build something together, and, you know, that's that God really seems to be so evidently in, and there's so much fruit and good stuff. It's really hard to sever ties from that and walk away from that. There's so much community you have in that space, and it's really hard to walk away from that and not have connection to that. Honestly, also, you're believing for the best, you know, you're hoping, like there's so many times where we spoke to Mike about things and really hoped we could help him change, really, you know, said, hey, you need to get some help, you know, and actually confronted him in a kind way. And we never gave up on that either. And so, yeah, it's a really complicated one to answer. And like I say, I feel like I wish I had walked away from there earlier than I did. And I wish we'd severed ties stronger than we did. But there was a lot of reasons why we didn't.
Yeah, and I think on reflection, you know, it's clear. We, other than confronting Mike, we didn't really give him any boundaries. We allowed him to pick us up and drop us over and over again. You know, I share in the documentary, my first, you know, interaction with Mike as an employee was a 6 month period of being utterly shunned. And there was a lot of psychological bullying that went on that I didn't go into in the documentary, where he would pull me up on stage and say, you know, Beth's got a word from God. I never heard about this before. I didn't have a word from God, you know, and he was laughing and pally. And, you know, that was a terribly frightening experience, confusing experience. But, you know, the minute that he was suddenly, you know, the switch flicked and he was okay with us again, we were right there, you know, whatever you want, we'll drop everything.
It's tough to understand.
And that was a long-standing pattern. And we didn't just invite him into our lives, we invited him into our children's lives. And those things later came at a great cost. And we've had to do some soul searching and take ownership for that too, because I'm sure those factors also made it hard for some people to believe when they first heard this. So, you know, we acknowledge that too.
Yeah, and that, you know, and there's something about the nature of coercive control here and the control of an abusive person, you know, who you don't sometimes quite realize how much under the spell you are. And one thing that's been discouraging, at the same time encouraging, is so many of the people we spoke to say the same thing. Like, it was so hard to walk away. I don't know why we didn't do it sooner. I don't know why we retained any sense of connection with him. And that's been a common thread running through so many of the people who have been mistreated too. So it's an interesting dynamic. I don't really understand it.
I mean, it's clear that Mike was an incredibly charismatic person. And I think that with people like that, you know, if he hadn't had the good side, he wouldn't have been able to do the bad things, because people would have just got fed up. But because, like, as you explained so well in the documentary, Matt, you know, you were seeing such fruit, you were seeing so many thousands coming to know Jesus. It must have been so confusing for you in your 20s to be seeing this amazing move of God, and yet this person at the center of it who was much darker than you realized. And that must have taken you many, many years to navigate and to process and to understand. Where are you now in your journey? Do you feel like that journey of healing is complete, or is that something that you're still in the process of?
I think it's a little bit of an ongoing process, only because I went a lot of years before I had some kind of professional help and counseling, but I've been really grateful for that. And honestly, it's so easy to put everything here through a discouraging lens, but actually, as we mentioned in the documentary, and as Dr. Diane Langberg mentions, there is change. There is a start of a sign of the church starting to make this more of a conversation, and churches starting to get to grips with some of the safeguarding stuff. And honestly, when we put out a little statement with the documentary online, we wanted to make sure we acknowledged all those pastors who are so faithfully week in, week out, serving their flocks and loving their people and treating them well. And that's really important not to lose sight of that as well, isn't it? Actually, there's some really beautiful examples of leadership around as well.
Yeah, that's so good, Matt. But also that our prayer was that the documentary doesn't sound like Matt and Beth Redman are still stuck in 1997. You know, they're, you know, triggered and traumatized, and they haven't moved forward. You know, in so many ways we have. You know, we're free from so much of this, but yet in another way, it can still feel like it just happened when someone else bravely tells you their story and you start walking with them, and you again begin to realize the scale of this. You know, this isn't just Matt and I speaking out about a lone experience. You know, not only did, you know, close to 150 people come forward to say, I was abused by this person, there are so many who never spoke to the National Safeguarding Team, who will never even tell their families, who won't go forward to the police, who will not speak about this because they are still so traumatized and confused. And those are the things, it's those days that I think we feel a deep weight and a pain. But I think we've been able to separate what we went through, and forgiving Mike you know, was a process. Jesus talks about that process, you know, it's a 70 times seven thing. It's an ongoing process, you know, but I feel I can say hand on heart that we do release him, and we would love nothing more than for him to come to repentance and for God to do what only God can do, which is bring redemption and also restore the church in Watford, Soul Survivor, which is being so faithfully led by John and Claire Stevens and the team there, and just for God to keep moving there and doing beautiful things out of the ashes.
Yeah, I thought there was a really powerful moment in Let There Be Light where you said, you know, you talked about forgiveness, and you said it's not about forgiveness, it's about accountability. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on what accountability looks like now when it comes to Mike. What would you like to see happen next?
I don't know, honestly, the answer to that. Some of that you really have to leave to the Church of England and their processes. I have been really encouraged that they did this investigation and they did it quickly, which has not often been the case, and that they substantiate all these claims. But there does seem to be a bit of a distinct lack of an actual discipline measure of some kind or another. And so, yeah, be very interesting to see what happens there. I don't really think we're the people to say what that should be, but I think it would be very helpful to people to realize you can't do all of this and have all this substantiated and then not really have some form of discipline at the end of it.
Yeah, important things that are happening right now are conversations about, you know, should investigations happen within the Church of England? Should they be immediately handed to a third party, to somebody independent to look into things? I think those are important questions. And it is shocking that Mike was able to resign. He wasn't defrocked, that he hasn't received, you know, any sort of measure of discipline. Knowing what we know, knowing what was in that, you know, NST report, knowing that, it's staggering to me. But those are the things we have to let go and let God. You know, I think Matt and I were so heartened when Archbishop Justin Welby made an unprecedented statement in support of those coming forward before the investigation was, you know, when it really only had just started. You know, that was a huge gesture. And it meant more to us than I can imagine. You know, I can't explain. Then subsequently seeing this kind of tumbleweed of like, okay, so there's all of this has come out, but it's kind of off he goes. And if he got a written warning, and if he wants to reapply for ministry, he can. That's staggering when we know what we know.
Do you have any message for those leaders that have stayed silent on this? Is there anything that you would want to say directly to them at this stage?
Not from me.
No, I think you can't make demands, and it's not our right to expect that. I think it's fair to say silence is very painful when you are a survivor. But we can only pray that people who have positions of leadership will pray and weigh what is their responsibility before God for their congregation, and for them to respond accordingly.
Mm. And finally, you know, we're going to be looking at the lessons to be learned for the church more broadly as a next step in our podcast, Soul Survivors. Just wondered if you both had any thoughts about what you feel the lessons are here for the church.
I think one of the big lessons is, and we go into this in the Let It Be Light documentary, like, make sure we listen. Make sure if someone comes forward with something that sounds like it even might be possible or plausible, you have to listen. It doesn't matter who they are. It's very important that people are heard, and, you know, validating people's experiences, very, very important. Something we go into in the documentaries, sometimes people rush to support the structures of the church rather than the actual individuals within it. And there's a lot to think about there. And there are some brilliant resources out there that can really help congregations navigate that and become stronger and safer.
Thanks, Matt. Any final thoughts, Beth?
No, I support that. And I think the only thing, you know, I'm so grateful for anyone who's watched the Let There Be Light documentary and understood the heart and the message and perhaps the takeaway, because we do encourage people to come forward, to bring things from darkness into light. And almost, we're not doing that on our own. We believe Jesus is doing that, that Jesus is the light, and he's calling people to come forward out of that darkness, shame and pain. But perhaps what we didn't say strongly enough is, what about all the people who have done that historically, and they were met with, you know, silence, or they were met with, you know, there was no follow through? You know, that's what needs to change. Please, please, can we create systems where leaders are accountable, that there's follow through? And that's what I think is so important about this Casey-led review by Fiona Scolding, Casey, that Soul Survivor has commissioned. It's her job to look at where were the failings, who should have acted, who failed to act, who knew about this, what documents are there, what evidence is there to show that these leaders and trustees and chairs and knew about this and still chose to look the other way. That is important, that those people are also held to account, and that leaders actually have the fear of God, that if someone comes forward, I've got to get this right. And there is a process that needs to be followed. Anyone can say anything. It's important that these things are followed through. But the people who speak out are not just supported and validated, but there is justice.
Yeah, Beth, absolutely. And this is something we will be exploring in the next episode of the podcast. So thank you so much, Matt and Beth, for joining us and sharing so powerfully a bit more about your story.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan.
It's lovely to speak to you.
If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can get confidential support and prayer by calling Premier Lifeline on 0300 111 0101, and calls are charged at your usual network rate. Lines are open every Monday to Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.